best in them. Instead, you want to bring out the worst. A subtle comment that makes them self-conscious and gets under their skin will turn them inward, get them lost in the labyrinth of their own thoughts. A seemingly innocent action that stirs an emotion like frustration, anger, or impatience will equally cloud their vision. In both cases, they will tend to misfire and start making mistakes. This works particularly well against rivals who must perform in some way. Deliver a speech, say, or present a project. The fixating thought or bad emotion you create in them makes them lose touch with the moment and messes up their timing. Do this right, too, and no one will be aware of your involvement in the bad performance, not even the rival you have one-upped. 4. In January 1988, Senator Robert Dole of Kansas could smell victory in his quest to become President of the United States. His main opponent for the Republican nomination was George H.W. Bush, the incumbent vice president in the administration of Ronald Reagan. In the Iowa caucuses, the first test in the primary season, Bush had been lackluster and had finished a distant third, behind Dole and televangelist Pat Robertson. Dole's aggressive campaigning had won him much attention. He had the momentum and was clearly the front runner. To Dole, however, there was one blemish to his great victory in Iowa. Lee Atwater, Bush's 36-year-old campaign strategist, had spread to the media a story that questioned the integrity of the senator's wife, former Secretary of Transportation Elizabeth Dole. The senator was an elected politician of nearly three decades standing and had developed the necessary thick skin, but attacks on his wife, he felt, were beyond the pale. He had a temper that his advisers worked hard to keep under wraps, and when the story broke, he lashed out at reporters, giving Atwater the opportunity to say, "He can dish it out, but if someone hits him back, he starts whining." Then Atwater sent Dole a 10-page letter enumerating the many times the Kansas senator had gone negative in the campaign, and this letter, too, made its way into the media. Dole was furious. Despite his victory in Iowa, he could not get over seeing his wife dragged into the dirt. He would get back at the Bush folk and Atwater. Next up was the New Hampshire primary. Victory here would put Dole well on his way, and he was ahead in the polls. But this time, Bush came out fighting, and the race tightened up. The weekend before the vote, the Bush people ran an ad portraying Dole as a straddler, a man with two faces whose Senate votes depended on expediency, not sincere belief. Humorous, deceptive, bitingly negative, the ad had Atwater's fingerprints all over it. And the timing was perfect. Too late for Dole to respond with an ad of his own. The ad helped propel Bush into the lead, and a few days later, to victory. Shortly after the results of the New Hampshire primary were in, NBC newsman Tom Brokaw caught up with Bush and asked if he had any message for his rival. "Nah," he replied with a smile, "just wish him well." Then Brokaw found Dole and asked the same question. "Yeah," said Dole with a bitter scowl, "stop lying about my record." In the days to come, Dole's answer was rerun again and again on television and discussed in the papers. It made him look like a sore loser. The press began to pile on, and Dole was ungracious. He seemed whiny. A few weeks later, he went down to a crushing defeat in South Carolina, and shortly thereafter an even worse string of losses in the Super Tuesday primaries throughout the South. Somewhere along the line, Dole's campaign had crashed and burned. Little did he suspect that it had all begun in Iowa. Interpretation. Lee Atwater believed that adults could be divided into two groups, the overly mature and the childlike. The overly mature are inflexible and overserious, making them highly vulnerable in politics, particularly in the age of television. Dole was clearly the mature type, Atwater the child. It didn't take Atwater much research to see that Dole was hypersensitive about attacks on his wife. Replaying old charges against her in Iowa, Atwater was able to get under the senator's skin. He kept Dole's blood boiling with the letter that accused him of starting the dirty campaigning, and he upped the pressure with the perfectly timed ad that mocked Dole's record for New Hampshire voters. Although Atwater was the one pushing buttons, Dole's outburst to Brokaw focused all attention on him and his unsportsmanlike behavior. Atwater, a genius at one-upmanship, now stood back. Dole could only respond with more sourness, compounding the problem and leading to electoral suicide. The easiest types to one-up are those who are rigid. Being rigid does not necessarily mean being humorless or charmless, but it does mean being intolerant of anything that breaks their code of acceptable behavior. Being the target of some anarchic or unconventional antic will trigger an overreaction that makes them look sour, vindictive, unleaderlike. The calm exterior of the mature adult is momentarily blown away, revealing something rather peevish and puerile. Do not discourage such targets from getting personal. The more bitterly they protest and criticize you, the worse they look. They forget that the real issue is how they are perceived by the people around them, or in an electoral race, by the public. Inflexible to the core, they can be induced to make mistake after mistake with the slightest push. 5. In 1939, Joan Crawford, 1904 to 1977, talked her way into a relatively minor role in the film The Women, the lower-class perfume sales girl who steals the husband of an elegant woman played by Norma Shearer. Crawford and Shearer were also bitter rivals in real life. Shearer was the wife of the movie producer Irving Thalberg, who always managed to get her the best parts. Crawford hated her for that, and for her haughty manner. Thalberg had died in 1936, but to Crawford's disgust, the studio was still pampering Shearer. Everyone in Hollywood knew of their mutual dislike and was waiting for the showdown. But Crawford was the consummate professional on the set, and she kept matters civil. The Crawford and Shearer characters in The Women share only one scene, the climax of the movie when Shearer finally confronts Crawford about the affair with her husband. The rehearsal went well, as did the master shot showing the two actresses performing together. Then it came time for close-ups. Of course, Norma Shearer went first. Crawford sat in a chair off-camera, delivering her lines to Shearer. Many actors would have an assistant or the director feed the lines while they retired to their dressing rooms, but Crawford always insisted on reading them herself. Crawford was knitting an afghan at the time, and as she said her lines, she knitted furiously, then stopped when it was time for Shearer to respond. She never looked Shearer in the eye. The needles made a loud clicking sound that began to drive Shearer crazy. Straining to stay polite, Shearer said, "Joan, darling, I find your knitting distracting." Pretending not to hear, Crawford kept knitting. Finally, Shearer, a woman famous for her elegance, lost control. She screamed at Crawford, ordering her off the set and back to her dressing room. As Crawford walked away, still not looking at Shearer, the film's director, George Cukor, ran to her side, but Shearer commanded him to come back. Her voice had a bitter tone that no one there had heard before, and few would forget. It was so unlike her. Or was it? In 1962, Crawford and Betty Davis, longtime stars who had never appeared in the same movie, were finally to co-star in Robert Aldrich's film Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. Crawford and Davis had never been thought to like each other too much, but Crawford had encouraged the pairing. As good publicity, it would help to extend their careers. Once again, their behavior was civil on set, but after the film came out, it was Davis, not Crawford, who was nominated for a Best Actress Oscar. Worse, she immediately started crowing about it, proudly announcing that she would be the first actress to win 3 Oscars. Crawford had only one. Davis was the center of attention at the Oscars. Backstage, before the event, she was unusually gracious to Crawford. After all, she could afford to be. This was her night. Only 3 other actresses were nominated, and everyone expected Davis to get it. Crawford was equally polite. During the ceremony, however, as Davis stood in the wings, waiting, she hoped, to accept the award, she got a shock. She lost. And Bancroft won for her role in The Miracle Worker. And there was more. As Davis stood taking it in, she felt a hand on her arm. "Excuse me," said Crawford, as she strode past the stunned Davis to accept the award on Bancroft's behalf. The Oscar winner could not be there that night. On what was supposed to be Davis's night of glory, Crawford had somehow stolen the limelight, an unbearable affront. Interpretation. A Hollywood actress has to be thick-skinned, and Joan Crawford was the quintessence of the Hollywood actress. She had a huge capacity to absorb and deal with insults and disrespect. Whenever she could, though, she plotted to get the last laugh on her various nemeses, leaving them humiliated. Crawford knew that people thought of her as somewhat of a bitch, a tough, even unpleasant woman. She felt this was unfair. She had been kind to many, but she could live with it. What annoyed her was how Shearer got away with playing the elegant lady, when in fact, Crawford believed, she was a nasty specimen beneath her charming exterior. So Crawford maneuvered to get Shearer to expose a side of herself that few had seen. Just that glimmer was memorable to the Hollywood community and humiliating to Shearer. With Davis, it was all in the timing. Crawford ruined her night of glory, which she had been gloating about for months, without even saying a mean word. Crawford knew that Bancroft would be unable to attend and learn from inside information that she would win, so she happily volunteered to accept the prize on her behalf. You will often find yourself nursing the desire to revenge yourself on those who have mistreated you. The temptation is to be direct, to say something honest and mean, to let people know how you feel. But words are ineffective here. A verbal spat lowers you to the other person's level, and often leaves you with a bad feeling. The sweeter revenge is an action that gives you the last laugh, leaving your victims with a sense of vague but corrosive inferiority. Provoke them into exposing a hidden, unpleasant side to their character. Steal their moment of glory. But make this the battle's last maneuver. That gives you the double delight of showing you are no one to mess with and inflicting a wound that sticks around. As they say, revenge is a dish best served cold. Reversal. Sometimes outright war is best. When, for example, you can crush your enemies by encirclement. In the ongoing relationships of daily life, though, one-upmanship is usually the wiser strategy. It may sometimes seem therapeutic to outfight your rivals directly. It may sometimes be appealing to send an overtly intimidating message. But the momentary gains you may earn with a direct approach will be offset by the suspicions you arouse in your colleagues, who will worry that someday you will strong-arm them, too. In the long run, it is more important to secure good feelings and maintain appearances. Wise courtiers always seem to be paragons of civilized behavior, encasing their iron fist in a velvet glove. Here are further reflections on the strategy of one-upmanship. By Baltazar Gracian. Life is war against the malice of men. From The Strategies of Psychotherapy, by J. Haley. First of all, a complete definition of the technical term one-upmanship would fill, and in fact has filled, a rather large encyclopedia. It can be defined briefly here as the art of placing a person one down. The term one down is technically defined as that psychological state which exists in an individual who is not one up on another person. To phrase these terms in popular language, at the risk of losing scientific rigor, it can be said that in any human relationship, and indeed among other mammals, one person is constantly maneuvering to imply that he is in a superior position to the other person in the relationship. This superior position does not necessarily mean superior in social status or economic position. Many servants are masters at putting their employers one down. Nor does it imply intellectual superiority, as any intellectual knows who has been put one down by a muscular garbage collector in a bout of Indian wrestling. Superior position is a relative term which is continually being defined and redefined by the ongoing relationship. Maneuvers to achieve superior position may be crude, or they may be infinitely subtle. For example, one is not usually in a superior position if he must ask another person for something, yet he can ask for it in such a way that he is implying, "This is, of course, what I deserve." From The Complete Upmanship by Stephen Potter. How to be one up. How to make the other man feel that something has gone wrong, however slightly. The life man is never caddish himself, but how simply and certainly often he can make the other man feel a cad, and over prolonged periods. The Art of Political Warfare by John Pitney, Jr. There are other ways to fray nerves. During the Gulf War, President Bush kept pronouncing the name of the Iraqi leader as Saddam, which loosely means shoeshine boy. On Capitol Hill, the ritual mispronunciation of a member's name is a time-tested way to rattle opponents or haze newcomers. Lyndon Johnson was a master of the practice. When Johnson was Senate Majority Leader, writes J. McIver Weatherford, he applied it with junior members who voted the wrong way. While slapping the young chap on the back and telling him he understood, Johnson would break his name into shreds as a metaphorical statement of what would happen if the disloyalty persisted. From The Complete Upmanship by Stephen Potter. When to give advice. In my own view, but compare Motherwell, there is only one correct time when the gamesman can give advice, and that is when the gamesman has achieved a useful, though not necessarily a winning, lead. Say 3-9 to play at golf, or in billiards 65 to his opponent's 30. Most of the accepted methods are effective, e.g. in billiards, the old phrase serves. It runs like this. Gamesman: look, may I say something? Layman: what? Gamesman: take it easy. Layman: what do you mean? Gamesman: I mean, you know how to make the strokes, but you're stretching yourself on the rack all the time. Look, walk up to the ball, look at the line, and make your stroke. Comfortable. Easy. It's as simple as that. In other words, the advice must be vague to make certain it is not helpful. But in general, if properly managed, the mere giving of advice is sufficient to place the gamesman in a practically invincible position. From Aesop's Fables. The Lion, the Wolf, and the Fox. A very old lion lay ill in his cave. All of the animals came to pay their respects to their king, except for the fox. The wolf, sensing an opportunity, accused the fox in front of the lion. The fox has no respect for you or your rule. That's why he hasn't even come to visit you. Just as the wolf was saying this, the fox arrived, and he overheard these words. Then the lion roared in rage at him, but the fox managed to say in his own defense, "And who of all of those who have gathered here has rendered your majesty as much service as I have done? For I have traveled far and wide, asking physicians for a remedy for your illness, and I have found one." The lion demanded to know at once what cure he had found, and the fox said, "It is necessary for you to flay a wolf alive, and then take his skin and wrap it around you while it is still warm." The wolf was ordered to be taken away immediately and flayed alive. As he was carried off, the fox turned to him with a smile and said, "You should have spoken well of me to His Majesty rather than ill." From The Head Game by Roger Kahn. Christy Mathewson, in his later years, recounted a knockdown incident from the first game of the 1911 World Series, which he won for the Giants, defeating the Philadelphia Athletics 2-1. Charles Albert "Chief" Bender started for the Athletics, and Bender was throwing harder that day than Mathewson had ever seen him throw. Twice, Bender drilled Fred Snodgrass, the Giants' young center fielder. When Snodgrass came to bat for the third time, in a pinch, Bender smiled at him. "Look out, Freddy," he said. "You don't get hit this time." Then he threw a fastball at Snodgrass's head. Snodgrass ducked. Ball one. "If you can't throw better than that," Snodgrass shouted, "I won't need to get a hit." Bender continued to smile. He had perfect teeth, Matthewson remembered. Then he threw a fastball strike that overpowered Snodgrass. "You missed that a mile," Bender said, grinning again. Snodgrass set his jaw in anger and began overswinging. "Grinning chronically," in Matthewson's phrase. Bender struck out Snodgrass with a curve that broke down into the dirt. Snodgrass was not afraid of Chief Bender's pitches. He was a solid hitter who finished with a lifetime average of 275. "What happened," Matthewson said, "was that a combination, the knockdown pitches, the sarcastic banter, the condescending grin, distracted Snodgrass." Then, having struck out his man, Bender pushed the needle deeper and twisted it. "You ain't a batter, Freddy. You're a backstop. You could never get anywhere without being hit." Although beaten that day, Chief Bender won two other games. The Athletics won the World Series 4-2. Across 6 games, the rattled Fred Snodgrass, a .294 hitter all season, batted .105. But as Matthewson interpreted the episode, he was a victim of gamesmanship, obviously and distinctly quite different from being terrorized. "Chief took Fred's mind right out of the game," Matthewson said. By Friedrich Nietzsche. Silence. The way of replying to a polemical attack, the most unpleasant for both parties, is to get annoyed and stay silent. For the attacker usually interprets the silence as a sign of contempt. From The Complete Upmanship by Stephen Potter. Glaciation is the name for the set of gambits which are designed to induce an awkward silence, or at any rate a disinclination to talk, on the part of possible opponents. The freezing effects of these gambits is sometimes of immense power. If someone else tells a funny story, do not, whatever happens, tell your own funny story in reply, but listen intently, and not only refrain from laughing or smiling, but make no response, change of expression, or movement whatever. The teller of the funny story, whatever the nature of his joke, will then suddenly feel that what he has said is in bad taste. Press home your advantage. If he is a stranger and has told a story about a man with one leg, it is no bad thing to pretend that one of your own legs is false, or at any rate that you have a severe limp. This will certainly silence opponent for the rest of the evening. If, for instance, someone is being really funny or witty, and there is a really pleasant atmosphere of hearty and explosive laughter, then A, join in the laughter at first, next B, gradually become silent, finally C, at some pause in the conversation, be overheard whispering, "Oh, for some real talk." And finally, from Strategies of Psychotherapy by Jay Haley. Inevitably, a patient entering analysis begins to use ploys which have placed him one up in previous relationships. This is called a neurotic pattern. The analyst learns to devastate these maneuvers of the patient. A simple way, for example, is to respond inappropriately to what the patient says. This places the patient in doubt about everything he has learned in relationships with other people. The patient may say, "Everyone should be truthful," hoping to get the analyst to agree with him and thereby follow his lead. He who follows another lead is one down. The analyst may reply with silence, a rather weak ploy in this circumstance, or he may say, "Oh?" The "oh" is given just the proper inflection to imply, "How on earth could you have ever conceived such an idea?" This not only places the patient in doubt about his statement, but in doubt about what the analyst means by "oh." Doubt is, of course, the first step toward one-downness. When in doubt, the patient tends to lean on the analyst to resolve the doubt, and we lean on those who are superior to us. Analytic maneuvers designed to arouse doubt in a patient are instituted early in analysis. For example, the analyst may say, "I wonder if that's really what you're feeling." The use of "really" is standard in analytic practice. It implies the patient has motivations of which he is not aware. Anyone feels shaken, and therefore one down, when this suspicion is placed in his mind. Chapter 29. Take Small Bites. The Fait Accompli Strategy. If you seem too ambitious, you stir up resentment in other people. Overt power grabs and sharp rises to the top are dangerous, creating envy, distrust, and suspicion. Often the best solution is to take small bites, swallow little territories, playing upon people's relatively short attention spans. Stay under the radar, and they won't see your moves. And if they do, it may already be too late. The territory is yours. A fait accompli. You can always claim you acted out of self-defense. Before people realize it, you have accumulated an empire. Piecemeal Conquest. On June 17, 1940, Winston Churchill, Prime Minister of England, received a surprise visit from the French General Charles de Gaulle. The Germans had begun their blitzkrieg invasion of the Low Countries and France a mere 5 weeks earlier, and they had advanced so far so fast that not only France's military, but its government as well had already collapsed. The French authorities had fled, either to parts of France not yet occupied by the Germans, or to French colonies in North Africa. None, however, had fled to England. But here was General de Gaulle, a solitary exile seeking refuge and offering his services to the Allied cause. The two men had met before, when de Gaulle had briefly served as France's Under-Secretary of State for War during the weeks of the Blitzkrieg. Churchill had admired his courage and resolution at that difficult moment, but de Gaulle was a strange fellow. At the age of 50, he had a somewhat undistinguished military record and could hardly be considered an important political figure. But he always acted as if he were at the center of things. And here he was now, presenting himself as the man who could help rescue France, although many other Frenchmen could be considered more suitable for the role. Nevertheless, de Gaulle might be someone whom Churchill could mold and use for his purposes. Within hours of de Gaulle's arrival in England, the French military sued for peace with the Germans. Under the agreement the two nations worked out, the unoccupied parts of France were to be ruled by a French government friendly to the invaders and based in Vichy. That same evening, de Gaulle presented Churchill with a plan. Broadcasting on BBC radio, he would address all Frenchmen still loyal to a free France and would urge them to not lose heart. He would also call on any who would manage to get to England to contact him. Churchill was reluctant. He did not want to offend the new French government with which he might have to deal. But de Gaulle promised to say nothing that could be read as treachery to the Vichy government, and at the last minute he was given permission. De Gaulle delivered the speech much as he had outlined it, except that he ended it with the promise he would be back on the air the next day. This was news to Churchill, yet once the promise had been made, it might look bad to keep de Gaulle off the air, and anything that would hearten the French during these dark days seemed worthwhile. In the next broadcast, de Gaulle was decidedly bolder. "Any Frenchman who still has weapons," he announced, "has the absolute duty to continue their resistance." He even went so far as to instruct his fellow generals still in France to disobey the enemy. "Those who rallied to him in England," he said, "would form part of a nation without territory to be called Free France, and of a new army to be called Fighting France, the spearhead of an eventual liberation of mainland France from the Germans." Occupied with other matters, and believing de Gaulle's audience to be small, Churchill overlooked the general's indiscretions and allowed him to continue his broadcasts, only to find that each new program made it harder to pull the plug. De Gaulle was transforming himself into a celebrity. The performance of the French military and government during the Blitzkrieg had been widely seen as a disgrace, And in the aftermath, no one had stepped forward to alter this perception of cowardice except de Gaulle. His voice radiated confidence, and his face and tall figure stood out in photographs and newsreels. Most important, his appeals had effect. His fighting France grew from a few hundred soldiers in July 1940 to several thousand a month later. Soon, de Gaulle was clamoring to lead his forces on a campaign to liberate French colonies in Central and Equatorial Africa from the Vichy government. The area was mostly desert and rainforest, and was far from the more strategic regions of North Africa on the Mediterranean, but it contained some seaports that might be useful, and so Churchill gave de Gaulle his backing. The French forces were able to take Chad, Cameroon, the French Congo, and Gabon with relative ease. When de Gaulle returned to England late in 1940, he now had thousands of square miles of territory under his control. His command, meanwhile, had swelled to close to 20,000 soldiers, and his bold venture had captured the imagination of the British public. No longer the low-order general who had sought refuge months before, he was now a military and political leader. And de Gaulle was equal to this change in status. He was now making demands of the English, and acting in a rather aggressive manner. Churchill was beginning to regret giving him so much leeway. The following year, British intelligence discovered that de Gaulle had been making important contacts among the growing French resistance movement. The resistance, which was dominated by communists and socialists, had started off chaotic, lacking a coherent structure. De Gaulle had personally chosen an official in the pre-war socialist government, Jean Moulin, who had come to England in October 1941, to help unify this underground force. Of all de Gaulle's maneuverings, this was the one that could benefit the Allies most directly. An efficient resistance would be invaluable. So, with Churchill's blessing, Moulin was parachuted into southern France in early 1942. By the end of that year, the increasingly imperious de Gaulle had so offended many within the Allied governments and armies, particularly U.S. President Franklin D. Roosevelt, that a plan was discussed to replace him with someone more malleable. The Americans believed they had found the perfect man for the job, General Henri Giraud, one of France's most respected military officials, a man with a record far more distinguished than de Gaulle's. Churchill approved, and Giraud was named Commander-in-Chief of French forces in North Africa. Sensing the Allied plot, de Gaulle requested a personal meeting with Giraud to discuss the situation. After much bureaucratic wrangling, he was granted permission and arrived in Algiers in May 1943. The two men were at each other's throats almost immediately, each making demands to which the other could never agree. Finally, de Gaulle compromised. Proposing a committee that would prepare to lead a post-war France, he drafted a document naming Giraud as commander-in-chief of the armed forces and co-president of France with de Gaulle. In return, de Gaulle got the committee to be expanded in size and cleansed of officials with Vichy connections. Giraud was satisfied and signed on. Shortly thereafter, however, Giraud left Algiers for a visit to the United States, and de Gaulle, in his absence, filled the expanded committee with Gaullist sympathizers and resistance members. Upon Giraud's return, he discovered that he had been stripped of much of his political power. Isolated on a committee that he had helped to form, he had no way to defend himself, and in a matter of months de Gaulle was named sole president, then commander-in-chief. Giraud was quietly retired. Roosevelt and Churchill watched these developments with increasing alarm. They tried to intervene, making various threats, but in the end they were powerless. Those BBC broadcasts that had started out so innocently were now listened to avidly by millions of Frenchmen. Through Moulin, de Gaulle had gained almost complete control of the French resistance. A break with de Gaulle would put the Allies' relationship with the resistance in jeopardy, and the committee that de Gaulle had helped form to govern post-war France was now recognized by governments around the world. To take on the general in any kind of political struggle would be a public relations nightmare destructive to the war effort. Somehow this once undistinguished general had forged a kind of empire under his control. and there was nothing anyone could do about it. Interpretation. When General Charles de Gaulle fled to England, he had one goal, to restore the honor of France. He intended to do this by leading a military and political organization that would work to liberate France. He wanted his country to be seen as an equal among the Allies, rather than as a vanquished nation dependent on others to regain his freedom. Had de Gaulle announced his intentions, he would have been seen as a dangerous mix of delusion and ambition. And had he grabbed for power too quickly, he would have shown those intentions. Instead, supremely patient, and with an eye on his goal, he took one small bite at a time. The first bite, always the most important, was to gain himself public exposure with first one BBC broadcast, then, through clever maneuvering, an ongoing series. Here, exploiting his keen dramatic instincts and hypnotic voice, he quickly established a larger-than-life presence. This allowed him to create and build up his military group fighting France. He took his next bite by bringing those African territories under the control of fighting France. His control over a large geographical area, no matter how isolated, gave him unassailable political power. Then he insinuated himself into the resistance, taking over a group that had been a communist bastion. Finally, he created, and bite by bite gained complete control of, a committee to govern the free France of the future. Because he proceeded in such a piecemeal fashion, no one really noticed what he was up to. When Churchill and Roosevelt realized how far he had insinuated himself into the resistance, and into the minds of the British and American publics as France's destined post-war leader, it was too late to stop him. His preeminence was a fait accompli. It is not easy to make one's way in this world, to strive with energy to get what you want without incurring the envy or antipathy of others who may see you as aggressive and ambitious, someone to thwart. The answer is not to lower your ambitions, but rather to disguise them. A piecemeal approach to conquest of anything is perfect for these political times, the ultimate mask of aggression. The key to making it work is to have a clear sense of your objective, the empire you want to forge, and then to identify the small outlying areas of the empire that you will first gobble up. Each bite must have a logic in an overall strategy, but must be small enough that no one senses your larger intentions. If your bites are too big, you will take on more than you are ready for and find yourself overwhelmed by problems. If you bite too fast, other people will see what you are up to. Let the passage of time masterfully disguise your intentions and give you the appearance of someone of modest ambition. By the time your rivals wake up to what you have consumed, they risk being consumed themselves if they stand in your way. By Edmund Burke. Ambition can creep as well as soar. Keys to Warfare. At first glance, we humans might seem hopelessly violent and aggressive. How else to account for history's endless series of wars, which continue into the present? But in fact, this is somewhat of an illusion. Standing out dramatically from daily life, war and conflict compel disproportionate attention. The same can be said of those aggressive individuals in the public realm who are constantly grabbing for more. The truth is that most people are conservative by nature. Desperate to keep what they have, they dread the unforeseen consequences and situations that conflict inevitably brings. They hate confrontation and try to avoid it. That is why so many people resort to passive aggression to get what they want. You must always remember this fact of human nature as you plot your way through life. It is also the foundation for any fait accompli strategy. The strategy works as follows. Suppose there is something you want or need for your security and power. Take it without discussion or warning, and you give your enemies a choice, either to fight or to accept the loss and leave you alone. Is whatever you have taken, and your unilateral action in taking it, worth the bother, cost, and danger of waging war? Which costs more, the war, which might easily escalate into something large, or the loss? Take something of real value, and they will have to choose carefully. They have a big decision to make. Take something small and marginal, though, and it is almost impossible for your opponents to choose battle. There are likely to be many more reasons for leaving you alone than for fighting over something small. You have played to your enemy's conservative instincts, which are generally stronger than their acquisitive ones. And soon, your ownership of this property becomes a fait accompli, part of the status quo, which is always best left alone. Sooner or later, as part of this strategy, you will take another small bite. This time your rivals are warier. They are starting to see a pattern. But what you have taken is once again small, and once again they must ask themselves if fighting you is worth the headache. They didn't do it before, why now? Execute a fait accompli strategy subtly and well, as de Gaulle did, and even though a time may come when your goal becomes clear, and when they regret their previous pacifism and consider war, by that time you will have altered the playing field. You are neither so small nor so easy to defeat. To take you on now entails a different kind of risk. There is a different, more powerful reason for avoiding conflict. Only nibble at what you want, and you never spark enough anger, fear, or mistrust to make people overcome their natural reluctance to fight. Let enough time pass between bites, and you will also play to the shortness of people's attention spans. The key to the fait accompli strategy is to act fast and without discussion. If you reveal your intentions before taking action, you will open yourself to a slew of criticisms, analyses, and questions. How dare you think of taking that bite? Be happy with what you have. It is part of people's conservatism to prefer endless discussion to action. You must bypass this with a rapid seizure of your target. The discussion is foreclosed. No matter how small your bite, taking it also distinguishes you from the crowd and earns you respect and weight. When Frederick the Great became king of Prussia in 1740, Prussia was a minor European power. Frederick's father had built up the Prussian army at great expense, but had never really used it. The minute he put the army in play, he knew, the other European powers would have united against him, fearing any threat to the status quo. Frederick, though massively ambitious, understood what had kept his father in check. The same year he took the throne, however, an opportunity presented itself. Prussia's great nemesis was Austria, where a new leader, Maria Theresa, had recently become empress. There were many who questioned her legitimacy, though, and Frederick decided to exploit this political instability by moving his army into the small Austrian province of Silesia. Maria Theresa, wanting to prove her toughness, decided to fight to take it back. The war lasted several years, but Frederick had judged the moment well. He finally threatened to take more territory than Silesia alone, and in the end, the Empress sued for peace. Frederick would repeat this strategy again and again, taking over small states here and there that weren't worth fighting for, at least not hard. In this way, almost before anyone noticed, he made Prussia a great power. Had he begun by invading some larger territory, he would have shown his ambitions too clearly and brought down upon himself an alliance of powers determined to maintain the status quo. The key to his piecemeal strategy was an opportunity that fell into his lap. Austria was at a weak moment. Silesia was small, yet by incorporating this neighboring state, Prussia enriched its resources and put itself in position for further growth. The two combined gave him momentum and allowed him space to slowly expand from small to large. The problem that many of us face is that we have great dreams and ambitions. Caught up in the emotions of our dreams and the vastness of our desires, we find it very difficult to focus on the small, tedious steps usually necessary to attain them. We tend to think in terms of giant leaps toward our goals. But in the social world, as in nature, anything of size and stability grows slowly. The piecemeal strategy is the perfect antidote to our natural impatience. It focuses us on something small and immediate, a first bite. Then, how and where a second bite can get us closer to our ultimate objective. It forces us to think in terms of a process, a sequence of connected steps and actions, no matter how small, which has immeasurable psychological benefits as well. Too often the magnitude of our desires overwhelms us. Taking that small first step makes them seem realizable. There is nothing more therapeutic than action. In plotting this strategy, be attentive to sudden opportunities and to your enemy's momentary crises and weaknesses. Do not be tempted, however, to try to take anything large. Bite off more than you can chew, and you will be consumed with problems and disproportionately discouraged if you fail to cope with them. The fait accompli strategy is often the best way to take control of a project that would be ruined by divided leadership. In almost every film Alfred Hitchcock made, he had to go through the same wars, gradually wresting control of the film from the producer, the actors, and the rest of the team. His struggles with screenwriters were a microcosm of the larger war. Hitchcock always wanted his vision for a film to be exactly reflected in the script, but too firm a hand on his writer's neck would get him nothing except resentment and mediocre work. So instead, he moved slowly, starting out by giving the writer room to work loosely off his notes, then asking for revisions that shaped the script his way. His control became obvious only gradually, and by that time the writer was emotionally tied to the project, and however frustrated, was working for his approval. A very patient man, Hitchcock let his power plays unfold over time, so that producer, writer, and stars understood the completeness of his domination only when the film was finished. To gain control of any project, you must be willing to make time your ally. If you start out with complete control, you sap people's spirit and stir up envy and resentment. So begin by generating the illusion that you're all working together on a team effort. Then, slowly nibble away. If in the process you make people angry, do not worry. That's just a sign that their emotions are engaged, which means they can be manipulated. Finally, the use of the piecemeal strategy to disguise your aggressive intentions is invaluable in these political times, but in masking your manipulations, you can never go too far. So when you take a bite, even a small one, make a show of acting out of self-defense. It also helps to appear as the underdog. Give the impression your objectives are limited by taking a substantial pause between bites, exploiting people's short attention spans, while proclaiming to one and all that you are a person of peace. In fact, it would be the height of wisdom to make your bite a little larger upon occasion, and then giving back some of what you have taken. People see only your generosity and your limited actions, not the steadily increasing empire you are amassing. Reversal. Should you see or suspect that you yourself are being attacked bite by bite, your only counter-strategy is to prevent any further progress or fait accompli. A quick and forceful response will usually be enough to discourage the nibblers, who often resort to this strategy out of weakness and cannot afford many battles. If they are tougher and more ambitious, like Frederick the Great, that forceful response becomes more crucial still. Letting them get away with their bites, however small, is too dangerous. Nip them in the bud. Here are further reflections on the fait accompli strategy. From the I Ching. Shen development. Gradual progress. This hexagram is made up of sun, wood penetration above, i.e. without, and ken, mountain stillness below, i.e. within. A tree on a mountain develops slowly according to the law of its being, and consequently stands firmly rooted. This gives the idea of a development that proceeds gradually, step by step. The attributes of the trigrams also point to this. Within is tranquility, which guards against precipitate actions, and without is penetration, which makes development and progress possible. and by General Von Nguyen Giáp. All the conceptions born of impatience and aimed at obtaining speedy victory could only be gross errors. It was necessary to accumulate thousands of small victories to turn them into a great success. Chapter 30. Penetrate their minds. Communication strategies. Communication is a kind of war. Its field of battle, the resistant and defensive minds of the people you want to influence. The goal is to advance, to penetrate their defenses and occupy their minds. Anything else is ineffective communication, self-indulgent talk. Learn to infiltrate your ideas behind enemy lines, sending messages through little details, luring people into coming to the conclusions you desire, and into thinking they've gotten there by themselves. Some you can trick by cloaking your extraordinary ideas in ordinary forms. Others, more resistant and dull, must be awoken with extreme language that bristles with newness. At all cost, avoid language that is static, preachy, and overly personal. Make your words a spark for action, not passive contemplation. Visceral communication. To work with the film director Alfred Hitchcock for the first time was generally a disconcerting experience. He did not like to talk much on the sets of his movies, just the occasional sardonic and witty remark. Was he deliberately secretive or just quiet? And how could someone direct a film, which entails ordering so many people about, without talking a lot and giving explicit instructions? This peculiarity of Hitchcock's was most troublesome for his actors. Many of them were used to film directors coddling them, discussing in detail the characters they were to play and how to get into the role. Hitchcock did none of this. In rehearsals, he said very little. On the set, too, actors would glance over at him for his approval, only to find him napping or looking bored. According to the actress Thelma Ritter, "If Hitchcock liked what you did, he said nothing. If he didn't, he looked like he was going to throw up." And yet somehow, in his own indirect way, he would get his actors to do precisely what he wanted. On the first day of shooting for The 39 Steps in 1935, Hitchcock's two leads, Madeline Carroll and Robert Donat, arrived on the set a little tense. That day they were to act in one of the movie's more complex scenes, playing relative strangers who, however, had gotten handcuffed together earlier in the plot, and still handcuffed, were forced to run through the Scottish countryside, actually a soundstage, to escape the film's villains. Hitchcock had given them no real sign of how he wanted them to act the scene. Carroll, in particular, was bothered by the director's behavior. This English actress, one of the most elegant film stars of the period, had spent much of her career in Hollywood, where directors had treated her like royalty. Hitchcock, on the other hand, was distant, hard to figure out. She had decided to play the scene with an air of dignity and reserve, the way she thought a lady would respond to the situation of being handcuffed to a strange man. To get over her nervousness, she chatted warmly with Donat, trying to put both him and herself in a collaborative mood. When Hitchcock arrived on set, he explained the scene to the two actors, snapped a pair of handcuffs on them, and proceeded to lead them through the set, across a dummy bridge and among other props. Then, in the middle of this demonstration, he was suddenly called away to attend to a technical matter. He would return soon. They should take a break. He felt in his pockets for the key to the handcuffs, but no, he must have mislaid it. And off he hurried, ostensibly to find the key. Hours went by. Donat and Carroll became increasingly frustrated and embarrassed. Suddenly they had no control, a most unusual feeling for two stars on set. While even the humblest crew members were free to go about their business, the two stars were shackled together. Their forced intimacy and discomfort made their earlier banter impossible. They could not even go to the bathroom. It was humiliating. Hitchcock returned in the afternoon. He had found the key. Shooting began. But as the actors went to work, it was hard for them to get over the experience of that day. The movie star's usual cool unflappability was gone. Carol had forgotten all her ideas about how to play the scene. And yet, despite her and Donat's anger, the scene seemed to flow with unexpected naturalness. Now they knew what it was like to be tied together. They had felt the awkwardness, so there was no need to act it. It came from within. 4 years later, Hitchcock made Rebecca, with Joan Fontaine and Laurence Olivier. Fontaine, at 21, was taking her first leading role and was horribly nervous about playing opposite Olivier, who was widely recognized as an actor of genius. Another director might have eased her insecurities, but Hitchcock was seemingly doing the opposite. He chose to pass along gossip from the rest of the cast and crew. No one thought she was up to the job, he told her, and Olivier had really wanted his wife Vivian Leigh to get the part. Fontaine felt terrified, isolated, unsure. Exactly the qualities of her character in the film. She hardly needed to act. And her memorable performance in Rebecca was the start of a glorious career. When Hitchcock made The Paradigm Case in 1947, his leading lady, Ann Todd, was appearing in her first Hollywood movie and found it hard to relax. So in the silence on set before the director called action, Hitchcock would tell her a particularly salacious story that would make her laugh or gasp in shock. Before one scene in which she had to lie on a bed in an elegant nightgown, Hitchcock suddenly jumped on her, yelling, "Relax!" Antics like this made it easy for her to let go of her inhibitions and be more natural. When cast and crew were tired on set, or when they'd gotten too casual and were chatting rather than concentrating on their work, Hitchcock would never yell or complain. Instead, he might smash a light bulb with his fist, or throw his teacup against a wall. Everyone would quickly sober up and recover his or her focus. Clearly, Hitchcock mistrusted language and explanation, preferring action to words as a way of communicating, and this preference extended to the form and content of his films. That gave his screenwriters a particularly hard time. After all, putting the film into words was their job. In story meetings, Hitchcock would discuss the ideas he was interested in, themes like people's doubleness, their capacity for both good and evil, the fact that no one in this world is truly innocent. The writers would produce pages of dialogue expressing these ideas elegantly and subtly, only to find them edited out in favor of actions and images. In Vertigo, 1958, and Psycho, 1960, for example, Hitchcock inserted mirrors in many scenes. In Spellbound, 1945, it was shots of ski tracks and other kinds of parallel lines. The murder in Strangers on a Train, 1951, was revealed through its reflection in a pair of glasses. For Hitchcock, evidently, images like these revealed his ideas of the doubleness in the human soul better than words did. But on paper, this seemed somewhat contrived. On set, the producers of Hitchcock's films often watched in bewilderment as the director moved the camera, not the actors, to stage his scenes. It seemed to make no sense, as if he loved the technical side of filmmaking more than dialogue and the human presence. Nor could editors fathom his obsession with sounds, colors, the size of the actors' heads within the frame, the speed with which people moved. He seemed to favor these endless visual details over the story itself. And then the film would be a finished product, and suddenly everything that had seemed peculiar about his method made perfect sense. Audiences often responded to Hitchcock's films more deeply than they did to the work of any other director. The images, the pacing, the camera movements swept them along and got under their skin. A Hitchcock film was not just seen, it was experienced, and it stayed in the mind long after the viewing. Interpretation. In interviews, Hitchcock often told a story about his childhood. When he was around 6, his father, upset at something he had done, sent him to the local police station with a note. The officer on duty read the note and locked little Alfred in a cell, telling him, "This is what we do to naughty boys." He was released after just a few minutes, but the experience marked him indelibly. Had his father yelled at him, as most boys' fathers did, he would have become defensive and rebellious. But leaving him alone, surrounded by frightening authority figures in a dark cell with its unfamiliar smells, that was a much more powerful way to communicate. As Hitchcock discovered, to teach people a lesson, to really alter their behavior, you must alter their experience, aim at their emotions, inject unforgettable images into their minds, shake them up. Unless you are supremely eloquent, it is hard to accomplish this through words and direct expression. There are simply too many people talking at us, trying to persuade us of this or that. Words become part of this noise, and we either tune them out or become even more resistant. To communicate in a deep and real way, you must bring people back to their childhood, when they were less defensive and more impressed by sounds, images, actions, a world of pre-verbal communication. It requires speaking a kind of language composed of actions, all strategically designed to affect people's moods and emotions, what they can least control. That is precisely the language Hitchcock developed and perfected over the years. With actors, he wanted to get the most natural performance out of them, in essence, to get them not to act. To tell them to relax or be natural would have been absurd. It would only have made them more awkward and defensive than they already were. Instead, just as his father had gotten him to feel terror in a London police station, he got them to feel the emotions of the movie. Frustration, isolation, loss of inhibition. Of course he hadn't mislaid the handcuff's key somewhere on the set of the 39 Steps, as Donat later found out. The supposed loss was a strategy. Instead of prodding actors with irritating words, which come from the outside and are pushed away, Hitchcock made these feelings part of their inner experience. And this communicated immediately on screen. With audiences, too, Hitchcock never preached a message. Instead, he used the visual power of film to return them to that childlike state when images and compelling symbols had such a visceral effect. It is imperative in life's battles to be able to communicate your ideas to people, to be able to alter their behavior. Communication is a form of warfare. Your enemies here are defensive. They want to be left alone with their pre-existing prejudices and beliefs. The more deeply you penetrate their defenses, the more you occupy their mental space, the more effectively you are communicating. In verbal terms, most people wage a kind of medieval warfare, using words, pleas, and calls for attention like battle axes and clubs to hit people over the head. But in being so direct, they only make their targets more resistant. Instead, you must learn to fight indirectly and unconventionally, tricking people into lowering their defenses, hitting their emotions, altering their experience, dazzling them with images, powerful symbols, and visceral sensory cues. Bringing them back to that childlike state when they were more vulnerable and fluid, the communicated idea penetrates deep behind their defenses. Because you are not fighting the usual way, you will have an unusual power. From Samurai Zen, The Warrior Koans, by Trevor Leggett. The priest Ryokan asked Zen master Bukan for an explanation of the four Dharma worlds. Bukan said, "To explain the four Dharma worlds should not need a lot of chatter." He filled a white teacup with tea, drank it up, and smashed the cup to pieces right in front of the priest, saying, "Have you got it?" The priest said, "Thanks to your here and now teaching, I have penetrated right into the realm of principle and event." The Mastermind. In 1498, the 29-year-old Niccolò Machiavelli was appointed secretary of Florence's Second Chancery, which managed the city's foreign affairs. The choice was unusual. Machiavelli was of relatively low birth, had no experience in politics, and lacked a law degree or other professional qualification. He had a contact in the Florentine government, however, who knew him personally and saw great potential in him. And indeed, over the next few years, Machiavelli stood out from his colleagues in the chancery for his tireless energy, his incisive reports on political matters, and his excellent advice to ambassadors and ministers. He won prestigious assignments, traveling around Europe on diplomatic missions, to various parts of northern Italy to meet with Cesare Borgia, to ferret out that ruthless statesman's intentions on Florence, to France to meet with King Louis XII, to Rome to confer with Pope Julius II. He seemed to be at the start of a brilliant career. Not all was well, however, in Machiavelli's professional life. He complained to his friends about the Chancery's low pay. He also described doing all the hard work in various negotiations, only to see some powerful senior minister brought on board at the last moment to finish the job and take the credit. Many above him, he said, were stupid and lazy, appointed to their positions by virtue of birth and connections. He was developing the art of dealing with these men, he told his friends, finding a way to use them instead of being used. Before Machiavelli's arrival in the Chancery,